Hello everybody and welcome to another episode. In this episode we're going to talk about Linux security. It's quite a broad topic, but we're going to talk about Linux desktop security in general and in Linux server security in general. I'm Mark Clark. I'm from South Africa. I live in Johannesburg and I work for an open source solutions company in Johannesburg. I'm joined by my co-host Darlene Parker. Hi Darlene, how are you today?
I'm great, Mark. How are you today?
All right, thanks.
All right. So just to refresh people's memory, my name is Darlene, and I am in Calgary, Alberta, Canada, and I work for a Linux-based company that provides solutions around the world. And also today we're joined by another guest, Mohamed Ayed, and he is located in Libya, and he's also a Linux expert, and I'm sure he has lots to share with us today about Linux security. Hello, Mohamed, how are you?
Hello, Mark. Hello, Doreen. I'm fine, thank you. First of all, I'll introduce myself. I'm Mohamed Ayaz from Libyan Spy Network. Libyan Spy Network is a web hosting company based on Libya. I'm working as a Linux server administrator, and I dedicate most of my time to Linux in general.
So first off, let's talk about Linux desktop security. I think as more and more people start using Linux on their desktops, probably going to get more and more reports of security breaches on the Linux desktop. You know, I think that's one of the inevitable things that's going to happen. You know, if you look at your standard Linux distributions when you install them by default, they don't have a whole lot of ports open listing, you know, unprotected ports listing for incoming traffic on the internet. But there's still vectors of attack that are there. Darlene, what do you think about Linux desktop security? I know you work quite a bit with that.
Well, I think that the only truly secure machine that you have is a standalone machine that's not connected to the internet at all. So whether you're running Windows, Linux, VSD, whatever, I think you still have to be aware that there are some holes that, you know, we do promote that Linux is that much more secure. But again, like you talked about, some of the services that are running, are they always necessary? Because like I did an install of Fedora 10, and then I just made a, you know, a text document of all the services that we're running, and some of them are geared for when you're on a network, you know, on a LAN, and some of those aren't. So those aren't necessary if you're a standalone desktop user, maybe in your home or whatever. So I think people just need to be aware. It's similar to when you run msconfig on a Windows machine. There's lots of services that are running that don't necessarily need to be there, and so I think that's the first step, is to be aware. You know, just to spend a little time on your system and become aware of it. What do you guys think?
Yeah, especially for the user move it to Linux. Mm-hmm. From Windows to Linux, they think about Linux is okay. They don't pay any attention for security, so they ignore it and they don't care about the surfaces and the firewall and stuff like this. So there should be more attention if they move to Linux. So they heard about Linux security, and Linux is more secure. More secure doesn't mean that it's secure. It's not right. Completely secure. It still has the vulnerabilities. We have a surface, and these surfaces have vulnerability. To be more secure with the Linux box, and we have to update it frequently with the latest update for the kernel, for the surface, and doing some hardening for surface to be more secure. What do you think?
Yeah, I believe that's true, that you should harden your system up, because, you know, we talk about, is Linux, you know, secure by default or by design? I think by design that it is secure, more secure than what we're used to with other operating systems, but I would not necessarily agree that it's secure by default. What do you think, Mark?
Yeah, look, I think, you know, the design part of Linux, its architecture is much more inherently secure than you know, then they say Windows came from. Look at Windows came from, was designed for a single user environment, and to this day, even though they, you know, claim to have rewritten the code completely, it has that, you know, that heritage. Whereas Linux was written much earlier, and it was built for a multi-user environment, so it has all that stuff built in. So I think it is more secure by design. But as you say, you know, a lot of the stuff is what's installed and what's running in terms of applications rather than the operating system itself. And today there's a bit of a blurring of the lines. What's the application, what's operating system? You know, with Windows you get Internet Explorer bundled and all of that. Because if you look at most of these hacking contests that they have, you know, and the people that win them, the vector of attack is always the browser, and they break into the system via the browser. So, you know, like Firefox, for example, you know, if they hack into Firefox, then who's responsible for that? because that will be a vulnerability on Windows or on Linux. So it's difficult. I think in the desktop arena, you know, you're always going to have security breaches. It's much harder to lock things down because you're basically relying on people, you know, what they're installing, you know, what sites they're going to, how savvy they are in terms of, you know, like any con artist. If some people will be conned by con artists, other people will be able to detect that it's a con and, you know, not fall for it. So it's quite difficult on the user desktop side. I think as we see more people using Linux on the desktop side, we'll definitely get more reports of security breaches. You know, it's like the I Love You virus that was sent around, and when was it, in about 2000 or something like that. I mean, that wasn't anything clever. What was clever, there was a social engineering aspect of it. You know, somebody gets an email from some or one of their friends because they're in the address book and it says, I love you. And they think, gee, what's going on here? They click on the attachment and it was just a basic VB script, you know, which anybody could write, anybody could do. So, you know, there's that aspect that nothing's really going to catch that, you know, if you're smart enough with the social engineering aspect of it. So, yeah.
Yeah. And like you talked about before, Mark, is that when people just click on random pop-ups on their desktop, whether they're running Linux, Windows, Apple, or Mac, or whatever, it still comes down to common sense, right? If you don't know what that pop-up's about, or you didn't go, this is what I advise I give people, especially regarding pop-ups and stuff. If you don't go looking for it and it comes to you randomly, ignore it.
Yeah.
No? Yeah. As we started our recording by talking about desktop security for Linux desktop security, I mean, Linux become more popular operating. So if we start searching about the malware that picked Linux, this, as you say, darling, Linux is became more popular. So I think that the hacker, they will start targeting Linux machine before it's not that popular, and most of the Linux user before is geek. And these geek things, Linux popular inside their team.
Right.
They are geeking. They are meeting together, and they're popular. Okay, it's popular in your area and with your friends. All your friends are geek. But now it's more popular for all users. Mm-hmm. But I think it will be more targeted with the hackers. What do you think, Mark?
Yeah, look, I think it'll definitely be harder for hackers to break into Linux and the Windows machines. You know, it's because what will happen is, you see, at least with Linux, you know, if somebody does break in and the person's using logged in as a normal user, you know, I think that's where Ubuntu's got it right in terms of forcing people to use sudo to get root access rather than, you know, logging in as root, is that the person will be able to hack in and just destroy the, you know, the user's home directory or hack into that. You know, so us Linux guys will claim, well, that's great because the system's secure, it's unhacked. You know, but from a user point of view, if they lost all of their, I mean, they don't really care about the binaries and the operating system and all of that. You know, they care about their data. You know? So even though we say, well, it's secured and it's, you know, if it was in a multi-user system, let's say it's one user account gets hacked, they can only really destroy that user's directory. But in today's world, I mean, you have, you know, computers dedicated to one person. So, for example, on your laptop, you don't have multiple users normally running on it. So, to all intents and purposes, if the home directory gets hacked, you know, the machine's hacked, and it's of no use to the, you know, to the user of that machine. So, I do think it's, you know, it's one of those things which is going to become more and more of an issue. You know, we've got to be careful of the success of our own, what would you call it, marketing, as it were, because everybody automatically says, you know, I can just, you know, it's almost like I'm invincible if I'm running Linux. And then, of course, that has its own problems in terms of when things do go wrong, then people think, but I thought I was safe.
Yeah, but I think the advantage to Linux, though, is if there are some issues, the response time of the Linux community is much faster than if you were a proprietary software developer, software provider. Like, they sometimes can take 3, 4, you know, 6 weeks to eat. Well, that's probably even a small one. Because I was actually just reading that while I was getting ready for today. Adobe Reader has issues that it even compromises Linux desktops, and I actually sent that to our development team, because we've got the latest. It's the newest reader, 9.1, 8.1, and 7.1, that you actually have to turn off the JavaScript. And it says in their blog release here on their update that, yes, it can affect your Linux machines. So who would know?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And that come in that way, right? But that's proprietary software. And their first response was back in April. They posted this, that there was a potential reader issue, and they're still trying to deal with it. So like I say, the community, I think the Linux community is much faster to respond to these kind of threats than a proprietary software company.
But, I mean, you know, one thing as well that's also a potential solution to all of these things, I mean, it also sort of touches a bit on the server side, because you can use these solutions on the server side as well, are things like Security Enhanced Linux or SE Linux, and the new thing from, you know, AppArmor from Novell. Those are different solutions to the problem, because basically the stance that they take is you never know whether this app's going to be secure or not, or what vector of attack's going to come through it. So you kind of wrap the application, as it were, and tell it that this application can only do X, Y, and Z. It can only access this directory or access these ports, that kind of thing. So even if it does get hacked, it's limited what can happen. And I think maybe that's a potential solution in future, but I just have to make it a lot easier for your average user to use. Because I know most people just switch off SE Linux, you know, when they install their system. It's just too complicated to manage.
Yeah. So I just have a final thought that I'd like to share about desktop security, and that is, you know, maybe having a standard that's just like IP tables with policies that are set so nothing gets in and some normal services can get out. Have either of you configured that, IP tables or anything like that on your side?
I tend to use it more on the server side than my desktop, you know, and I think that's the point. Yeah. And IP table is quite hardcore for your average user to set up. I know there's a whole lot of GUI tools these days, but still, you know, if your average user says, do you want to block port 80 or, you know, they don't even know what you're talking about, you know, if you say, even if you say you want to block web traffic, they don't really understand. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, so it's a difficult, you know, scenario. And I think also...
But we're straddling here. We're talking to just ordinary users, but we're also talking to IT administrators who, you know, will be taking care of desktops, right? Because as they become more popular. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I tell you what. I mean, like, I know on my machine, like, I do development work. So you install all kinds of services. You try out different things and that. You know, I don't necessarily uninstall them. And you take your laptop over, you know, to another network somewhere. You plug it in, and you just so it's not necessarily also, you know, it's also supposed to what you call it, people who aren't diligent, maybe like you know, and you leave these ports open, or you got to share. You quickly want to transfer a file to another machine in your home network, so you know, you just make the share public, and that's okay when you're at home, you know. Then you take your machine and you dump it on some public network, or especially these Wi-Fi hotspots, you know, and next minute your machine's like wide open. So it is something which also, you know, you've got to take into account the human factor, I think, as well.
Using firewall IP tables is actually, Darlene, these days is more easier than before. As we see a lot of graphic interface on board, we can find a lot of graphic interface using IP table surfaces, like I think Firewall Starter or something like this, and Ubuntu Firewall. And yeah, this graphical interface make IP tables easy to use, easy to configure. Not just like before, it's not easy even for the administrator, especially if you are trying to configure your server starting from the rules deny all, and you have to start open only required surfaces.
Right.
So these days. Popularity for Linux, it's come from more easy to more friendly. That's why it's became popular.
Right, especially with the advent of the GUI for it, right?
just one comment I also want to make before we move on to the server side of things as well is, you know, one thing I do think which is a bit of a limitation of the current design structure of Linux, you know, is this whole group. You know, you can only really define access to a file or a resource by owner, group, and then other. You know, so you can't have these complex group structures, which is quite, you know, somehow make it difficult to manage. Now, I know they do have ACLs in Linux these days, but you don't find it widely used. You know, I think we need to also potentially, as we start using Linux more and more, you know, how to say, okay, you know, Joe is part of the current group that can have access to these files. He's also part of this group that can have, you know, I don't know, a read-write access to another set of files, and you can give both groups, you know, different rights to different files rather than just a single group that you can assign to it. But in the past, you have to go add Joe to all these different groups, and it's a bit of a difficult task. So I think, yeah, you know, this ACL thing, I know it's been in Linux for a while now, but it's not sort of in widespread use because you need to use extended attributes in the file system.
In this case, I think you should be using security enhanced Linux, which have a more advanced permissions and a more advanced access list for user. But security enhanced Linux, we will return to, it's not easy to configure, especially for normal user, if we're talking about a normal user, and we're talking about a multi-user machine, if you want to put more security level in that machine. So you have to configure security enhanced Linux to avoid this, and giving more advanced permission and access list to control, take over control of the user. So what do you think about this? We have to install antiviruses for our Linux box or maybe Mac box.
Yeah, I don't tell them to put antivirus on. I just tell them to stop all the unnecessary services that get started when they do a default install.
So on the server side, I think you do need to run antivirus for the sole purpose, especially if you've got like a Samba share. Because you know everybody's storing their files there, and then obviously even though Linux is invulnerable to the Windows viruses, other Windows users can access those files and get attacked. But I have yet to find a decent antivirus package that can run on a Samba share and do like on access scanning and all of that kind of stuff. I don't know whether you've got any there, Mohammed or Dolly.
Yeah, I agree with you, actually. I agree with you about it's required in case, as we know that these days we have a hybrid network. Some machines Windows and some machines Linux running in the same network, and they can share resources. So I don't want my workstation to be as a distribution point for viruses to Linux user, to Windows user, actually. So as you say, that we need these antiviruses to protect actually Linux Windows user from being attacked or being infected from my workstation, Linux workstation. Actually, we are partner for Kaspersky, so we have this. Kaspersky have an engine for Samba server, do antivirus for Samba server. Mm-hmm. I tried once, one time, and it's nice. It's using the same database to use it with the workstation, so it will be effective with your Linux machine. Yeah.
Okay. Now we tried. What was it? The guys, well, the Windows guys supplied us. They went and bought the license. They didn't consult us on it, and they bought that AVG license. But it was a real schlep. You had to recompile the kernel and add in this module, and then you know it was like a major effort just to get to run this antivirus thing, which meant that you know all future upgrades now it was just a pain. If you upgraded your kernel, it meant you know your antivirus would stop working and all of that. So I don't know whether is it the same.
It's the same.
Yeah.
So that's what it's the same. It's not easy to configure it.
Yeah, they're just saying that I think there's some space here that maybe the Linux community needs to sort of look at a bit and make it easier to integrate these antivirus, even if it's just Clam AV, you know, into the whole like on access scanning capabilities of Samba. I'm surprised it hasn't happened in the past, because relying on, you know, if you rely on the Windows client machines to be running the latest antivirus, that never really works. It's always somebody who is turned off updates or something like that. You know, and then all you need is one of those guys, and this happens at clients, you know, quite often, where just one person can infect the whole Samba share, you know.
Yeah, actually, most of the vendors considering, oh, we will make a product for Linux users, so most of Linux users are provisional, so we don't have to make interface, just only with commands, blah, blah, so that's why it's not easy to install. Kaspersky, it's not easy to do. They don't have a actual interface with a graphical interface for user, normal user to running Kaspersky under Linux.
And I don't know if the architecture Samba, I'm not a Samba developer, even look at the code at all, but you know, they could provide some sort of API hooks into like Win files or Red to be able to make it easier to run that antivirus. Because typically what you have to have is like these modules which like rnotify, which sort of let you know, that call it when the file changes and then calls the antivirus and all of that. So you would think it would be easier to, you know, there would be easy, better hooks available, especially on the Samba side, since it's used, I mean, that's what it's designed for, so integration to Windows networks, that there'll be more ability to do sort of server-side scanning of files. Okay, so I think we could maybe just talk a little bit about the server side of things. Like, I think it's a different aspect completely than the desktop side, because you're relying on the fact that you've got a server administrator who knows a bit more about what's going on than your average user. Plus, you're also not running a whole bunch of like things like, you know, web browsers and email clients on the server. So it eliminates a whole bunch of possibilities there in terms of virus attack vectors. But of course, it opens up a whole bunch of other vectors for attack, like misconfigured servers and that kind of stuff. Now, Mohammed, I know you've got a lot of experience in this area, because you run quite a large hosting provider there in Libya?
We are a hosting company, and we are facing a lot of hacking attempting from our server. So after we doing some research and following the guideline for security, we found Apache is not secure by default. Okay. I'm not talking about the service itself, the vulnerabilities for the Apache, but it's not secure if you don't using the third-party modules, or you have to make a hardening for Apache to work more secure.
Okay. What kind of attacks are you seeing manifesting there in terms of the Apache server in particular?
Yeah, users, they can running script from one account to other, jumping to from account to another account, and they can using running some commands from Apache, because by default Apache using nobody user by default, so mm-hmm. nobody user can follow with nobody user.
Yeah.
Who's doing that action if you're trying to tracking the some action happen, mm-hmm. so we have to doing a lot of work with Apache to make it more secure.
Well, I mean, if I look at, we also do some web hosting outside, and most of the attacks that we get come from poorly implemented sites that we host. So it's not a direct attack on Apache as such. You know, it'll be like a cross-site scripting attack because the guy, or a SQL injection attack because they haven't escaped the SQL properly within their application code. But it's not necessarily from the text that we kind of see. It's not necessarily a exploit in Apache itself. So it tends to be around that. I mean, you can do hardened PHP and those good things, but then you end up, you know, also there's a bit of a trade-off because then the system becomes more and more difficult to actually use. So yeah, I'm just interested more in finding out the kind of attacks that are being directed that you guys are seeing on your servers. Because to be honest, most of ours are just spammers, you know, trying to basically send automated bots to just add this spam comments to sites endlessly, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, as I mentioned that, I was talking about, it's okay, Apache is, as a service itself, it have vulnerabilities. Mm-hmm. So even in the latest version for Apache, they have a vulnerability and they didn't fix it yet.
Okay,
but the script kiddie. We are talking about script kiddie. We're not talking about that. The professional hackers, they will use Apache itself to hack the server.
Okay.
So most of the script kiddie using the way that Apache is running, like running nobody user, mm-hmm. to running maybe PHP shell or something like this in your server, and they start trying to having a backdoor in the server and get that. Giving a rootkit, they're trying to get access to the server, and also they're jumping from the from account to account on the same server to trying to hack some pages and get the database and stuff like this.
Yeah.
But it's not this is not vulnerability in Apache actually. It's like the way that the default configuration for Apache. We're using third-party modules with the, like mod security. It's like a web file wall. You have to, any web server that doesn't have mod security is open for public, so that any user can do anything for the server, for the nobody users actually, if they using this default user for Apache, and also using super user PHP modules to protect the user from running a script under another user account. So these tools really is very helpful and can protect your server and can save a lot from attack.
Okay, so what you're recommending is people look at running mod security and SUPHP to kind of...
SUPHP, exactly.
It's a kind of thing. Okay, and in terms of for us in our log files, we just basically run like a log watcher over the files looking for any critical messages and get emailed to us. So on a daily basis, do you have any early warning detection systems that you use to review your log files and automate that process?
Also we're using third-party tools like from Convict server. They providing free tools for firewall. It can be integrated with mod security, and it can be integrated with another surfaces to warn you with the abnormal action or maybe some attacks come to the server. So using this config service, the third party firewall, the professional hacker, they will use Apache itself to hack the server. So some most of the script kiddie using the way that Apache is running, like running nobody user to running maybe PHP shell or something like this on your server, and they start trying to having a backdoor in the server and get the giving a rootkit. They're trying to get access to the server, and also they're is jumping from the from account to account of the same server to trying to hack some pages and get the database and stuff like this. But it's not this is not vulnerability in Apache actually. It's like the way that the default configuration for Apache. This is only the default configuration. Okay, actually, to we're using third-party modules with the, like mode security. It's like a web firewall. You have to, any web server that doesn't have mode security is open for public, so like any user can do anything for the server, for the nobody users actually if they using this the default user for Apache, and also using super user PHP modules to protect. The user from running a script under another user account. So these tools really is very helpful and can protect your server and can save a lot from attack.
Yeah. Okay, so what you're recommending is people look at running mod security and SUPHP to kind of...
SUPHP, exactly.
It's a kind of thing. Okay, and in terms of your, I mean, for us in our log files, we just basically run like a log watcher on over the files looking for any critical messages and gets emailed to us sort of on a daily basis. Do you have any early warning detection systems that you use?
Yeah, also we're using third-party tools like from Convict Server. They're providing free tools for firewall. It can be integrated with mode security, and it can be integrated with another surfaces to warn you with the abnormal action or maybe some attacks come to the server. So using this config server, the third-party firewall.
For us, the main concern there is that it tends to use a lot of bandwidth. I mean, sometimes you can have like, you know, 20-30% of your bandwidth can be some guys just trying to post endless comments onto a forum site somewhere. You know, so what we do is we use like fail to ban for that kind of stuff, and for obviously attempts to hack your SSH port, which you have open for administration purposes. You know, on our side, we tend to run those things. The fail to ban is quite good in terms of at least saving your bandwidth and, you know, also preventing dictionary attacks and that kind of stuff. So we sort of have a different a different concern on our side at that. But I was having a look at mod security. Hopefully it stabilizes and we start introducing it into the official repositories and that, then I think I'll definitely use it. Like, you know, the approach also that mod security seems to be taken is very similar to AppArmor and SE Linux that we talked about earlier. I don't know whether you've had any experience with SE Linux, Darlene or Mohammed.
Actually, I have a bad experience with SE Linux. I configured one time my machine, so I faced a lot of problems, so I have to read the manual very carefully, especially the security enhanced Linux, and take it in the consideration every time when I install a new service, when I try to install a new application, because secure enhanced Linux have advanced access control and advanced and change a lot of kernel behavior. So once we install secure enhanced Linux, we have to take it in our consideration. We will face a lot of problem in the future, especially when trying to add a new service, add a new tools, add a new application to our machine.
Yeah, I mean, that's also been my experience with SE Linux. I mean, I've been reading articles recently. Apparently, they made it a lot easier to use now. I don't know how true that is, but, you know, I think AppArmor is giving them a bit of, you know, make them sort of be a bit more competitive. But I haven't used AppArmor myself, and also read, you know, the marketing hype is that AppArmor is really easy to use. But you know, I think what I understand AppArmor is that you basically have to download pre-configured profiles. So if you're downloading a pre-configured profile, and you can choose what applications you want to sort of protect. So it seems to me, and I could be completely wrong, that SE Linux kind of everything, you know, once you've got it installed, everything must be configured to run the SE Linux. But it looks like with AppArmor, you know, you say, look, I want you to protect this application. Otherwise, all other applications run, well, as under normal security kind of, what do you call it, mode. So, you know, like, let's say you've got
That sounds great. Yeah, that sounds great.
Because then you can just sort of wrap your Apache, because they've got like profiles for MySQL and Apache, so well, I want to like wrap Apache, I want to wrap MySQL, you know, and that's all ones you really supposed to care about, you know, more. You don't really care about wrapping, you know, some other sort of services and stuff which you don't really use that much or which aren't exposed to the internet, you know. So yeah, so I'm probably going to give AppArmor and Security Enhanced Linux a bit more of a, you know, give them some more attention and try them again. But yeah, but I think those are sort of looks like the you know, the next generation of attempts on security on the server side. Sometimes also security issues are actually design flaws in the architecture of the service itself. So, you know, no matter how sort of careful you are in setting up your machine, you're going to be exposed to them. I mean, a classic example of that was a DNS poisoning attack or vulnerability that was exposed last year. And all the vendors had to rush to patch their DNS servers. Mohammed, did you have any experience with that?
Yeah, I remember that when I heard the first time about this DNS poisoning, we inform our ISP to upgrade their DNS server, because when we checked their DNS server, we found that it's vulnerable to DNS poisoning.
But it was just sort of a vulnerability that was inherent in the architecture, the way DNS works. So you know, even if your DNS was written really secure, it was basically in this foundations how it works. So yeah, so you've got to be careful about those kinds of things. That's why it's also important to always patch your machines and make sure they're running the latest you know, security patches from your distribution. What I remember from the vulnerability, the way it works is that, you know, when you send out a DNS request, so you want to look up firstnationalbank.co.za, and it goes out to the DNS server. It sends a request to a DNS server. But your machine will respond to whichever machine responds first. So it doesn't look to see, okay, I sent this request to server, you know, ABC, and the response came from server XYZ. So what the vulnerability would do, as far as I understood it, was that it would just sort of almost spam sending out response addresses for, like, let's say, like, FNB is a big bank in South Africa. So it'll just sort of continually spew out responses for FNB, but mapping it to the incorrect IP address. And it'll just hopefully hit a machine that would make this request. So if your DNS server is doing, like, a recursive lookup, you could actually poison the cache of the DNS server because it'll just accept whatever response it got. It wouldn't check it. And so thereby, you know, you might think, well, that seems like really, you know, like a sort of gunshot approach to it. But if you took like a popular site like Facebook or something like that, you know, and you just kept this ring out, sooner or later you'd get a hit. So yeah, so that's when it comes down to the sort of the architecture of how these things are built.
I know that my challenge in my work has been to bring Linux out to the ordinary users, or to, you know, explain the difference between Windows and Linux, to tell people, you know, and I believe it's a real hands-on experience. So I know, Mohammed, that back in March, you had the first open day, first Linux day in Libya, and it was, you guys, was Fossil, right? So Free, you know, was the organization that you worked with to do that. Can you tell us a little bit more
Fossil,
about it?
Yeah. The organization behind this day is called Fossil, Free Open Source Software in Libya. This group established in 2008. The first event actually for us, it was Linux Day. It was the first Linux Day, the official Linux Day in Libya. Linux Day in Libya, this idea came from this group, and Libyan Spider, the company I'm working with, they was a sponsor for that day. And without this company, actually, that day would not come to show. And for Linux Day, we expect that about 400 people will participate in that day, but we surprised that it was at 1,300 come to that day. And we distribute about 900 Ubuntu CD, desktop Ubuntu CD for the user or for the participated people. Actually, in general, it was a very successful day for us, and after that day, a lot of people became and asking for Linux, and I'm still receiving a message from user. They're trying to get CD for Linux, and they want to try Linux because they heard about Linux and they don't try it before, and they thought that Linux is using a terminal. They don't. Linux doesn't have interface. Some users they still have thinking like this. Linux have no interface. Is Linux only for geek? Mm-hmm. But when we're running, actually, one from the important point we concentrate on Linux Day is running Combis actually.
Okay.
We have a Combis professional user with us, and they impress the people with the 3D effects for desktop and how they did. It's crazy, like crazy desktop for user. They seeing the effects, visual effects, so they like it. Wow. So most of the new user actually then now they are installing Ubuntu and going directly to install Combis and doing this action and blah blah stuff like this.
Ah, sounds like it was a great success there. I mean, I know, yeah, South Africa as well. You know, the government's also quite big into open source. At least officially, you know, they support a lot in terms of the open source, that software freedom. That our government, organizes activities around that. Was the Libyan government involved in any way in the show?
Actually, last year it was a successful year for Microsoft in Libya.
Oh dear.
Yeah, they have a contract. Yeah, they have a contract with the higher education. They have a contract with general education in Libya. They have a contract with the institute. They have a contract with the general electricals in Libya. They cover all most important sector in Libya, but. We can't convince user to or the government using open source without a planning. It will be a disaster, I think.
Yeah.
First of all, we have to build a community. We have to find the qualified people to support open source in Libya. Then we have the more power to convince the government or give them some proof that it's open source is the right choice and Linux it will be the future operating system. Now, to be honest, we don't have this power.
Okay.
But you also said last night, Mohammed, that you were doing a lot of translation because there wasn't a lot of documentation in Arabic, right, for open source. So there's another kind of a hurdle to overcome as well, eh?
Yeah, that's right. Actually, lately I was talking about we don't have rich resources for, in general, about Linux and open source in Arabic. We don't have a rich resources, and this is really make me sad because why with all language they have resources and in Arabic we have leakage. Okay, we have resources but not that much resources, and you can't depend on these resources, and most of the IT people don't following this Arabic documentation. For example, if I translate 1,000 pages from documentation in a professional way and give them to the IT people, professional IT people. Actually, they will not read it. They will go to find another documentation in English.
Okay.
But where are you aiming that documentation to? Is it to end users or to your system admins? Like, who are you trying to bring
in
over
general,
to? In general.
Actually, in general, yeah. As I told you yesterday that I'm trying to translate the whole official documentation for and community documentation for Ubuntu. I think it's about 1,500 pages.
Sure.
Wow.
This is not easy work to do by myself. I'm trying to find a volunteer to help me to contribute this project. And actually, the volunteer or contributors will be from the whole. Anyone can speak or understand both language, Arabic and English, and also should be involved in the IT field because translating the IT documentation requires some skills and some understanding. Yeah.
So let's put a call out there then for anybody that can help Mohammed there with a translation exercise. If they need to get hold of you, they can get hold of you at Spider Network, LibyanSpider.com, eh?
Yeah, LibyanSpider.com.
Okay, just send you an email from there. Okay, great stuff. Tell me, Mohammed, what's the? Do you guys have an active business software alliance organization in Libya at all? You know, the anti.
Copyright?
Yeah, copyright. Yeah. The guy looking for pirated copies and unlicensed versions of software and all of that. I mean, I know we got one year in South Africa.
Unfortunately, no.
Is it? We got one year in South Africa, and you know, like a few weeks ago, they released their latest report, and they said software piracy is up 1%, you know, from 34% to 35%. I mean, that means basically a third of all installations in Africa are unlicensed. Yeah, of course, they blamed this on all kinds of things like increasing access to international markets like Pakistan and what else did they blame? And then they blamed, oh yes, obviously they always like to blame broadband internet access for increasing piracy. Yeah, and they didn't even mention the fact that we're in the world's worst economic crisis since 1929, you know? And maybe people don't have money to pay for it. To pay for the software. To me, 1% increase is quite mild given the circumstances. But you know, one of the things I guess I'm trying to comment on, because often in like sort of third world countries like South Africa, and that there's high software piracy rates, and people and that's why free and open source software has a hard time competing against it, because essentially the software is also free. It's not open source, but it's also free in South Africa. And that's why people don't really see there's no economic need to potentially change from this. But what I do find is strange, though, is like you often find a lot of these Microsoft guys, you know, they'll come and they'll argue with you. As soon as you some like open source starts making inroads into an organization, they become very defensive and aggressive about it, you know, and they start to argue that, you know, Microsoft is better because it's paid for. And then you say to them, well, have you paid for your software, your version of Visual Studio and XP? And they say no. Well, if it's so great, why don't you pay for it? You know, so there's like this, there's a strange relationship. Yeah. Okay, I think that's a wrap for our quick episode on Linux security. We just really scraped the surface there and dealt with Linux security at a high level, and touching on some tools and ideas that you know that we sort of or discussions that we have about Linux security. I'd like to thank Darlene for joining us today, as well as Mohammed. Darlene.
Yeah, well, I'm glad that I was able to share some ideas and some insights with our listeners because, as we repeatedly said throughout the podcast, has Linux gained some popularity, that this will be something we will have to address. And again, I thank Mohammed for joining us as well and providing some really good information. And I hope our listeners enjoyed it and look forward to hearing from us again.
Yeah. Thank you, Dex. Thanks, Darlene. Thanks, everybody.
Yes. Okay.
Catch you next time.
All right.
Thank you for listening to Hack Republic Radio. HPR is sponsored by Caro.net, so head on over to caro.net for all your hosting needs.